Zelensky's finished. There's nobody can help him. He's done. So I thought, I just can't be right. Something missing in this picture. So there was this, there's this Czech news outlet, AE News, which gets very good scoops. And they published an article saying that according to leaks from Ukraine's intelligence, the reason why Zelensky couldn't do a deal with Trump is because he had already signed off over he had already signed over those resources to the Brits.
Alex Craner, good afternoon to you. How are you, my friend?
Good afternoon, Andy. Good to be with you. Greetings to everyone out there.
Well, thank you. So just for my listeners and viewers, Alex and I were going for a little bit off camera, trying to set this up. And interesting things going on, especially now. The last time we talked, it was about Germany going eastward, making friends or making alliances with potentially doing that with Russia. But there's some big stuff going on in the UK now, some big stories, and you told me that is the story, and then I just hit record. So what is the big story? What's dropping? Set that up for me in the UK.
Well, it's not in the UK per se, but is, you know, there is a big mess in the UK, but I think that the big story is the Ukraine mineral deal saga that is now bizarrely center stage of global geopolitics. And I thought it was so bizarre. So, you know, Trump comes on the scene and he's pressing Volodymyr Zelensky for a $500 billion rare earth minerals deal. And Volodymyr Zelensky, who is absolutely desperate for U.S. support in order for his government and his country not to implode, not only rejects the deal, he ends up insulting Donald Trump and embarrassing his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. I thought, that is so weird. There's got to be something more to this story, because the Ukrainian mineral resource deal, it's not that Donald Trump just woke up one morning and decided to be evil and greedy and squeeze the poor Ukrainians who are fighting for their freedom and democracy and, you know, human rights and all these wonderful things, as many people in the Western media are presenting it. It's Volodymyr Zelensky who came to Trump and met with him in New York on 27th September of last year, before Trump was even elected, because he realized that if Trump gets elected, that he's in huge trouble. And so he wanted to go and talk to Trump. And in order to kind of give him an incentive to continue supporting Ukraine, he offered him this 500 billion, you know, the number 500 billion comes from Zelensky, not from Trump. So he offered him this deal. And Trump said, yeah, all right, we'll talk about it, fine. And then, you know, fast forward to now, there's been Keith Kellogg going back and forth. There's been Scott Bessent going there with the deal a couple of days ago. There's been Secretary of State Marco Rubio going to Kiev. So they all talked about this deal. And the last thing was that Marco Rubio spoke with Zelensky about the deal. Zelensky said, yeah, we're doing the deal, no problem. I just need to, you know, I just need to run it through my legislative process to make it stick and all this. And then he goes to the media, Zelensky does, and he says, no, I rejected the deal. We're not doing this and so forth. And so Marco Rubio is, that's not at all what he said. He said he was accepting the deal and that we would do it. And, you know, so it was undiplomatic. It was inappropriate. And it was an insult to the administration. And at the same time, without U.S. support, Zelensky's finished. There's nobody can help him. He's done. So I thought, I just can't be right. Something's missing in this picture. So there was this, there's this Czech news outlet, AE News, which gets very good scoops. And they published an article saying that according to leaks from Ukraine's intelligence, the reason why Zelensky couldn't do a deal with Trump is because he had already signed off over he had already signed over those resources to the Brits. So what happened is that back in September, yeah, I mean, this is huge. This is not in the mainstream media, but it looks very plausible as a story. And I'll explain why I think that. So when Zelensky went over to the United States last September and spoke with Trump and offered this deal, the Brits decided to preempt Trump. And so what they did is they drafted this 100-year partnership agreement between the Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland and Ukraine. And Keir Starmer went to Kiev on the 16th of January this year, which is 4 days before Donald Trump's inauguration. And he and Zelensky signed this 100-year partnership agreement between the UK and Ukraine. And according to this, so this is not controversial. This is not conspiracy. This is all on the record. The deal, the agreement is on the British government website. You can download it in PDF and read it. No problem there. But the intelligence leak says that there's a secret appendix to the deal, which basically says that upon the cessation of hostility, basically all of the Ukraine's resources go to the UK. The UK takes control of them, namely all of Ukraine's ports, natural gas resources and storage facilities and pipelines, titanium, and on and on and on and on. So in exchange, well, the British committed to support Ukraine with no less than £3 billion per year for as long as necessary. That's one of the provisions of the of an addendum to the agreement. But you know, the Brits don't do charity. This is not a charitable donation. This is a consideration for something that is not named in the agreement. However, when you read the agreement, the 100-year partnership, it's not the whole agreement. You don't normally agreements have the whole agreement clause stating that all of the rights and obligations under this agreement by the respective parties are limited to what's spelled out in this agreement. There's nothing outside of the scope of this agreement that parties shall be liable for. This is like standard boilerplate that goes into almost all the contract. Instead, in this agreement, on Article 11 refers to additional provisions and things which may be necessary in pursuit of this agreement. So it means that there's like some kind of an open-ended provision that is not named in the agreement, but which could be part of this agreement. So that kind of indicates that there might be secret appendices. And then it also, so if this is true, 100% the Russians know about this. If the Russians know about this, 100% the Trump administration knows about this. And if the Trump administration knows about this, then this whole deal, song and dance between the Europeans and the Americans, is a sideshow. The real show is that the Trump administration is now, they turned the proxy war around. And so instead of the Western Empire, the Brits and NATO and Europe using Ukraine as a proxy in their war against Russia, now the Trump is using Ukraine as a proxy in his war against the Brits and the Europeans. And so that's insane, isn't it? Here's why I think this is happening. So Trump has been pressing Zelensky over these minerals, over these resources. I think probably knowing that he signed them over to the Brits. So he's just like putting them all on the spot. And then, you know, he threw in that Zelensky is a dictator and that he has 4% support in his country. So what did that do? Because Zelensky signed this 100-year agreement. Well, if he's not the legitimate representative of Ukraine, if he's not the president, then his signature on this 100-year deal is worthless. And so the whole thing is null and void. And so then there was like an absolutely hysterical reaction to Trump's statement from Britain, not only from Starmer and from all the media, but also from Nigel Farage, who is controlled opposition. His loyalty is with the City of London. And they all went like, oh, no, this is wrong. He's not a dictator. He's a duly, legitimately elected president of Ukraine. And okay, yes, so his term did expire, but he'll hold elections when it's appropriate, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, and then they started this whole narrative about how, you know, the United Kingdom didn't have election between 1935 and 1945 because the war and all of this and all of this. That's all very nice, but it's irrelevant. Ukraine has a constitution, which is supreme law of the land of Ukraine, which says that the presidential term is for 5 years. Sorry, something went down the wrong tube.
Right. Hey.
So the presidential term is 5 years, not a day longer. And under no circumstances can elections be delayed or president's term in office be extended. So the Brits kind of went bonkers over that. And then on 24th February, Boris Johnson goes to Kiev again. And two things happen on that same day. Well, no, on that same day, Boris Johnson states that, oh, Zelensky shouldn't reject this deal with Trump. The deal should be signed and Zelensky should sign it because that will commit the United States in black on white, to supporting Ukraine. And also that same day, the Verkhovna Rada, the parliament of Ukraine, issues a resolution saying that, yeah, Volodymyr Zelensky is legitimately still the president, his term is extended, and so all is well here. And then the very next day, Zelensky comes out and say, like, oh, yeah, you know, we'll do the deal with the Americans. We'll sign over those resources. And so today we are 28th February. Zelensky is in the United States, in Washington, to sign this deal. Well, the deal leaked out, or maybe it was published. I don't know if it was supposed to be out or not. Apparently, it's a complete dog shit, excuse the expression. It's a completely worthless contract that's so vague, it's not even clear who the parties is. The provisions are impossible to interpret. It's like a contract that you haven't even seen in cartoons. It's nothing. So here you have the head of state in Ukraine and the head of state in the United States meeting to sign a deal that is probably completely meaningless. And its scope is such that it might be construed as a treaty, in which case it would have to be ratified by the Senate in the United States. But it probably won't be, almost certainly won't be. And then it also will not be presented to the Ukrainian parliament. So to me, it seems that Boris Johnson basically went there and he said to Zelensky, we got to keep the Americans in. You can't reject this deal. So say that you'll accept it and we'll like draft some dog shit for them to chew on. And we'll gain time. And then we're going to make some kind of an arrangement. All we need to do is keep the Americans in, because without the Americans, we're all finished. And everything implodes. So it seems to me that this is what's going on. This is why we had this series of visits from Europeans. You know, all of the, not all of them, but a number of the attendees of the emergency summit on Ukraine that was held in Paris on the 17th February. They just one after the other invited themselves to go and talk to Trump. And they all, you know, like go into this chummy banter. Look how friendly we are and what wonderful partnership we have together, and we're allies and shared values and this and that and blah, blah, blah. With the objective of trying to persuade Trump to remain committed to Ukraine, to stop talking to Vladimir Putin, and to basically provide American support for Ukraine's security. Why is this important? Because the Brits are in catastrophic fiscal position. And so these resources in Ukraine, the reason why I think they kind of ran ahead of themselves and kind of yanked this deal under Trump's nose at the last minute, was because these resources could be the collateral that would enable the British financial system it would enable this large scale credit impulse. You know, it would be the collateral on the basis of which the British banks could issue credit and send British, European, American corporations to do this and that, to, you know, develop these resources and fund whatever reconstruction there, rearmament, whatever happens. Now, why are the Brits insisting on controlling the ports? Well, this is another thing that's very consistent with the geopolitics of the British Empire. If you control the ports, it makes it much easier to facilitate the flow of arms and troops and other things that you need to continue your effort to destabilize and destroy Russia. And even if your proxy dies, even if Ukraine is militarily defeated, that doesn't mean that the proxy war needs to end. You can continue it with a different proxy, which could be terrorists or narco-trafficking gangs. One of the main tools of British geopolitics for the last 200 years has been the opium wars. You know, you start flooding your target nation with drugs, and you basically, this is what's being done to the United States now. This is being done to the countries of West Africa because they're trying to kick the, you know, the colonialism out. So I think that this is why the Brits want to control the ports. But still, you know, they can't do it without the American support or else everything implodes. You know, the gates will slam shut for any Trojan horses that the Brits might like to slip into Ukraine to continue, you know, using it as a bludgeon against Russia. And then the Europeans have their own deal that they're proposing. This is being pushed around by Sébastien Séjourné, who used to be French foreign minister, more famous for being the husband of the prime minister of France, whose name escapes me now, but
I think I know who you're talking about.
You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah. Little guy.
Anyway, yeah, so consistent with bizarre French politics, a gay couple in the top of the French government and the foreign minister was appointed without having a single day of experience in foreign affairs of any sort. He was just appointed. Now he's some kind of an economic envoy who's pushing this European deal for Ukraine. Now the European deal is also trying to get a commitment from Ukraine for a post-war reconstruction. And the idea is to use the $260 billion that are frozen of Russian assets that are frozen in European banks, also for Europe to fuel a large-scale credit cycle. So the Russian assets would be used as collateral for European banks to finance reconstruction and development of Ukraine after the war. And the contracts would be obviously awarded to the clients of these banks, the European corporations. So it would be again, the main beneficiary would be the European private sector, primarily the banking sector. And so both Europe and the United Kingdom have invested very, very heavily in Project Ukraine. And they're up to their eyeballs in debt. Their economies are imploding on themselves. Their fiscal positions are horrible. Inflation's rising. Energy price. I mean, it's a dismal situation. And so, Project Ukraine, keeping it intact in some way, would give them a lifeline. So the plan is to develop the resources there and blah, 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 but basically to refloat the European and British financial systems. And all of it collapses without the American support. And now Trump understands all this perfectly well. So he knows that these jokers are in a desperate straits, that they're sinking, that they're asking for a lifeline, but they have nothing to offer, right? They can't make all their agendas stick without the American military supporting their troops on the ground. So they want to, you know, so what's necessary for the European deal, for the British deal, their 100-year partnership there to be viable, is they need to control Ukrainian government after the war. So they need to make sure that their guy, whether Zelensky or somebody else, is the president of Ukraine. and that they control who gets the resources, who gets the credit, who gets the contracts, and so forth. So for that, they need to place their troops on the ground. Okay. And so, you know, the Brits figure they can put in 10,000, and the French maybe a little bit, and maybe they can kind of coerce the Baltic states, you know, the Poles, the Romanians, if they can get rid of this Calin Georgescu, and so on, you know, maybe put together, say, 50,000 troops, which is very highly unlikely, but let's say maybe they could somehow finagle it over time and get there, and then let's say have a credible protection racket in Ukraine. But they still need the Americans, because, you know, without the American support, you know, the satellite, you know, access to satellite intelligence, to GPS, to targeting data, to like all of these advanced sophisticated weaponry requires US support, the logistics, that like without the Americans, they can just go there as, you know, as infantry and get slaughtered. That's pretty much it. With the Americans, maybe they're better off a little bit, but not so much. Anyway, to be able to make all this stick, they absolutely need the American support. Now, Trump made sure on the occasion of Keir Starmer's visit yesterday, 27th February, 25, to mention that Vladimir Putin can be trusted. You know, if I make a deal with him, I can rely on that. And everybody knows that. You know, Bill Clinton said, he gave an interview in 2013, and he said that in every deal they made with Vladimir Putin, he always kept his words.
Let me interrupt you. So I laughed because of just the irony. And just, I can see Trump just saying that. Oh, people.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not laughing at what you said. I'm not laughing at you, but I'm just...
Well, I know the whole thing seems like a bizarre farce, like a some kind of cheap low budget kabuki theater that
makes sense, though, the way you're laying it out. But go ahead.
Yeah, I think it doesn't, you know, because the interpretation I'm giving you may not be right, but it fits. Okay. If it were right, then everything we're observing would absolutely make sense. And so Vladimir Putin offered an alternative deal to Trump where, you know, he says, it's very doubtful that Ukraine even does have any of those rare earth minerals in any feasible form. I don't know whether this is true or not, but apparently is dubious. Nobody is quite convinced. And on the other hand, we in Russia have a lot more of it. And we're welcoming foreign partners to help us develop this, investments, technical support, whatever. And of course, we share the proceeds. So, you know, Vladimir Putin can offer richer deals than the Europeans. Vladimir Putin can provide security for free, you know, because he won the war. He can provide security without the Americans needing to send weapons, pay for troops, pay for Ukraine's government, backstop, you know, come to the defense of the tripwire troops that Brits and French are planning to send there, without having to risk World War III. He can just, so, you know, like the deal with Russians is next to no downside and a lot of upside. The deal with the Brits and the Europeans is a very dubious upside, because what Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson and all of these jokers are basically trying to say is give us security guarantees, back us up if we bring peacekeeping troops in Ukraine, and leave these resources in our capable hands, we'll make sure that you're happy with your part of the deal. And they have shown themselves to be absolutely untrustworthy and duplicitous. Mm-hmm. And so what's the choice here for Trump? He can have a really good deal with somebody you can rely on and who's trustworthy and who can provide security free of charge, or you can make yourself liable as a security guarantor to these people who are going to implode without your help, who are lying duplicitous snakes, with the risk of maybe ending up in a devastating nuclear World War III. I think the cost benefit analysis is quite clear. And so, you know, what does Keir Starmer do? He has nothing to offer. He goes there. He speaks with his sophisticated British accent. He's talking about, oh, our shared values. And then, you know, J.D. Vance says, like, well, you know, free speech, huh? I was like, oh, no, free speech is awesome. We love free speech. He pulls out, hand delivers a letter from King Charles, you know, the BFF of Jimmy Savile, inviting Trump to a second state visit to the United Kingdom and a dinner with the king. I mean, what a joke. I have nothing. They've got nothing. They're hoping that Trump will be dazzled by their British accent and with this chummy backslapping and talking what great friends we are and how in history we've always backed each other up all the way and blah, blah, blah. And then the invitation to have dinner with the king. Hey, you know, you can dine with the king.
Right. As opposed to a Russian czar, maybe.
And so, you know, if you've had a government of degenerates and morons in the White House, then this would all stick. Mm-hmm. You know, if Kamala Harris was in the White House and had, you know, Jake Sullivan there and I don't know, people like that, Victoria Nuland, they would jump on that. Oh, yeah, dinner with the king. Oh, yeah, you're so wonderful from London here. And, you know, it would be continuation of the Obama administration. You know, Obama and Eric Holder and a bunch of people in that administration should be hung for high treason over the HSBC money laundering case, from what you know, most people don't understand, but that was high treason on behalf of London. So, you know, they subordinated US rule of law to the interests of London. And so this would be just a continuation. But with the Trump administration, you have very sophisticated operators there who can read the small print, who understand the lay of the land, and who said, like, so basically you're offering us nothing in order for us to protect you and pull your coals out of the fire. And then maybe you'll be nice to us and share some of your, you know, the stealth act of piracy of yanking these resources under my nose 4 days before my inauguration. Maybe you'll share some of that with me. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it was interesting to see Trump's body language. And it seems to me that, well, A, he didn't commit to Ukraine security, very obviously. B, he did make a jab at, you know, he gave Starmer a compliment about his beautiful accent, which I think was like, I see you. I see what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then when somebody asked about Canada and Keir Starmer started, oh, you're inventing a division that doesn't exist. And then Trump cuts him off and says, that's enough, and goes to the next question. I mean, I've never seen that ever.
Yeah.
I mean, You know, like while the prime minister of your allied nation
is
speaking in a joint press conference, I've never heard somebody say that's enough.
So, I had so many questions on this, but you kind of answered some. But you really answered them, but I'd still like to ask them though. Wow, that's number one. If this is true, and I think there's something to this, because it didn't make a whole lot of sense of doing a deal with Ukraine, the U.S. and doing a deal with Ukraine for their, they have natural resources, it does, but I mean.
No, but it doesn't end even in that case, because.
You gotta piss off the Russians.
You can't make a deal with a country that is being defeated at war.
Right.
Before there's a peace settlement.
Yeah.
And the peace settlement has to involve Russia. So, you know, the whole British and European approach, the underlying assumption is the defeat of Russia, that Russia has no say.
Yeah.
Which is delusional, but they think if they can continue, you know, attacking Russia and somehow try to destabilize it, then maybe they can just ignore Russia's interests and just go forward with whatever they have in mind. But for Trump, obviously, that doesn't make any sense at all. So I think he's just playing along to give these people enough rope to just hang themselves with it. Because the agreement is complete nonsense. It precedes a peace agreement, the peace settlement. So it's basically worthless if you're signing an agreement with the defeated side. And then the winning side says, guess what? Your agreements are null and void. I mean, you know, if the next government in Kiev aligns with Moscow, then everything these Europeans and British had in mind is completely worthless. It's a pipe dream and nothing more than that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you said it just there. It's like you can't make a deal with the defeated party because it's no longer really... I said it's all due respect, but it's no longer their country.
Yeah, it would be like if you went into business with somebody who's on the verge of bankruptcy, you signed a contract with them, and then the next day they go bankrupt. Well, that's what your contract is worth, nothing.
Yeah. And another interesting point you brought up, well, you brought up several, but it's really the power play, and there's three separate now in the West. It's U.S., okay, and we'll put the U.S. over here, versus U.K., I get that, but then U.K. and Europe. I remember that when the U.K. was part of Europe, part of it, right?
Yes. You see, it's not what it seems.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have the European Union.
Yeah.
Which is fading.
Yeah.
You see, one of the people who went to visit, not Trump, but Marco Rubio, was his European counterpart, the Commissioner for Foreign Affairs, Kaya Kallas. She was supposed to meet with Marco Rubio. She flew to Washington. And then last minute, Marco Rubio canceled their appointment. So she came to Washington for nothing, which is such a diplomatic spit in the face. It's entirely possible that Marco Rubio forgot about his hair appointment or whatever the hell he needed to do other than that. But it's a slap in the face. It's a diplomatic humiliation of the European Union. So the signal is, we don't consider you a counterparty. We have no time for you. Go away. Mm-hmm. Apparently, according to some information I have, Ursula von der Leyen has been trying multiple times to get through to Trump on the phone. He's not taking her calls. And then you had Andrzej Duda, Polish president, who went to meet with Trump. And I think that Trump had him waiting for an hour and a half in order to have a 15-minute chit-chat with him. He had Emmanuel Macron, president of France, there. He set him at the corner of his desk in the Oval Office, like a schoolboy. You know, like, he was like, here, sit here. Well, let's just get this over with, you know? And so everybody received a subtle humiliation. Now, the real axis of power in Europe, I think, is always London, Paris.
Okay.
And I don't know exactly how to explain this, but it seems to me that it goes back to the old Rothschild agenda, where from Frankfurt, he sends his five sons to Paris, to London, to Vienna, Naples, and I don't know where else. And through history, it seems that whenever something really big is going on, something that's going to change the global order, very often London and Paris act in concert. So during the US Civil War, London and Paris were jointly supporting the South with the idea of splitting the and creating two weaker client states, you know, balkanizing the Union, and then, you know, doing the standard divide and rule. I've also observed that over the last 20 plus years, France has been humiliated by the Anglo-American axis on numerous occasions, but really humiliated. And they always subjugate themselves to this Anglo-American axis all the same. And I didn't understand this because I thought, okay, the French have their own elites. It's clear that Emmanuel Macron doesn't represent the French people, but you know, you have French industrialists and bankers and you know, this wealthy elite, which, you know, is getting beat up left and right, you know, from the coup in Haiti in 2003 or something, to the AUKUS deal, to the riots in France after, you know, Emmanuel Macron made a few mistakes. He said that Russia has legitimate security concerns and we have to talk to the Russians and acknowledge their security concern and come to some kind of an agreement. And then he went to China by himself and, I mean, by himself, you know, on behalf of France and French industries and businesses to cut deals with France. And then, boom, France gets slammed with these riots, which started to resemble the Maidan. And then he folds, and these riots vanish from one day to the next.
Yeah.
Remember that? So it's been,
I remember that.
It's been one smack in the face after the other, and every time they come back into the fold of the, you know, of the London-centered Western Empire. And I couldn't understand why that was until I listened to an interview with Pepe Escobar. And Pepe Escobar is a you know, veteran foreign correspondent based in Paris, very well connected, very well informed. And he just said something that clicked finally. And he said, with regards to Emmanuel Macron, oh, it doesn't matter. Everybody in Paris knows that Emmanuel Macron does whatever Alexander de Rothschild tells him to do. He's his daddy. And then I thought, well, done. Okay, so the London family and the Paris family, you know, probably worked together, and the guys in London told Alexander de Rothschild, go along with us, you know, once all of this is sorted, you're going to be fine. You're going to have opportunities to consolidate hold on France. never mind the rest of the French bankers, French industrialists, you know, the hell with them. And so that kind of explains, you know, for as long as Macron is in power, why France has been such a sucker for humiliation. It's not just Macron. It was the same with François Hollande, same with Nicolas Sarkozy. And so that, I think that's the real axis of power in Europe. The EU is a sideshow. And then, you know, you have satellites, which are more or less wobbly. But, you know, Germany is kind of still part of this. Sweden, Denmark, Italy, not so much anymore. But I think that the real solid axis is London, Paris. And for the reason that I mentioned, probably.
So what does Russia think of? I mean,
I think that the Russians and the Chinese know exactly who they're facing. They know exactly who the enemy is.
America.
And I think they know that it's exactly this axis, London,
oh,
there.
Got it. Right.
So, and I think that Trump understands this now as well. I think that over time, and then, okay, one thing I forgot to mention is that London has, over these last 10, 15 years, has made a number of treaties with key powers in Europe, all of them kind of, you know, like defense treaties with Sweden, with France, with Poland, and with Ukraine. And so this, you know, these countries are all now members of NATO, but these treaties are separate. They're not under the framework of the NATO alliance. They're separate bilateral treaties between Britain and Sweden, Britain and France, Britain and Poland, Britain and Ukraine. And they're all kind of aimed at antagonizing Russia and attacking Russia in some form. How it went with Ukraine is now obvious, but you know, they also want to use Poland as a beachhead against Russia, Sweden, and France. And so, you know, in other countries like Germany, like Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Romania, Croatia, Hungary, they're not really so much in London's orbit that they can rely on such alliances, because, you know, there's always possibility that the political process will bring somebody like Viktor Orban or Robert Fico to power. Now, I think that the next designated power to continue the fight against Russia is Romania. And, you know, now that the Romanians elected Calin Georgescu, who is dead against this, and this is why they elected him, they canceled elections in Romania. And so, you know, European democracy is going to be under attack, but to the extent that the people power matters, and it does matter, it matters critically, they're not going to be able to do what they plan to do.
You don't think so?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. The appetite for war against Russia is next to zero in Europe. Mm-hmm. It would take them a very long time. I would say probably anything between 5 and 10 years to even attempt to rearm European nations and to recruit enough troops willing to fight, it would, you know, it would be a process similar to what happened in Germany during the 1930s. But, you know, things have changed. A, we've seen the war between Russia and Ukraine. Most people in Europe do not think that we have to fear Russia. They do fear their own governments, because the governments in Europe are turning increasingly authoritarian and repressive. Mm-hmm. And so now, you know, to try to sell the narrative that, oh, you know, our way of life, our liberties and freedoms are under threat because the Russians are going to invade us and enslave us all. Nobody's buying that. You know, this is complete nonsense.
Yeah.
So it would take a great deal of propaganda and probably hundreds of billions of capital invested in the military industrial machinery to let's say weaponize Europe for another World War III against Russia. I don't think it's happening. And you know, during the 1930s, we didn't have social media, we didn't have the internet. And so the powers that be were able to control the narrative. There was ideological clash between, you know, capitalist Europe and communist Soviet Union. And so they were able to scare people with the, you know, spread of communism. And so we have to go and kill the Soviet Union. So I don't think the circumstances today are very, very different. And then, you know, not only that, you need charismatic leaders and you need compelling ideology. And we don't have any of that.
We don't have either.
I mean, up until Trump, their compelling ideology was basically LGBT ideology. Even to the point where in Sweden, a Swedish army had this marketing campaign to try to attract people into the army. And they, instead of Swedish flag, they use the LGBT flag with the slogan, "The flag worth dying for." How many people are going to get excited about that and say like, oh yeah, I'm willing to sacrifice myself for the LGBT flag. I mean, right. Talk about tone death, right?
Yeah. Oh, over the national flag. So I had Tom on a week ago and you brought up so many good points, but first I want your opinion on this because it really fits. Well, I think I know your opinion, but Tom made the comment to me and it blew my mind, but it made so much sense. Is Russia is going to be the guarantor of Europe now? And wanted to see what your thoughts were on that. And then number two, it seems like what you're saying is, I just want to flesh this out a little bit more too, is the old allies, allegiances, relationships, whatever, those are gone.
Yeah.
Those are all gone.
Yeah, yeah. And this is not just Andy and Alex saying this. This is, you know, on the Marco Rubio, in his confirmation hearings on 15 January this year, he made that statement explicitly. He said that the post-World War II order was more than obsolete, that it was now a weapon being used against us. Marco Rubio didn't come up with that by himself.
He's not far right-wing guy.
Yeah. That's the position of the Trump government. And that is about as spectacular as it gets. Because, you know, up until now, up until Donald Trump's inauguration, well, this is 15 January, so this is even before Donald Trump's inauguration. But the, you know, the world post-World War II global order was regarded as something that should be cherished and defended and cultivated forever because it gave us, you know, 70 years of peace and prosperity, blah, 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 blah. All of that is only partly true because it maybe gave peace and prosperity to the Western world, but all the rest of the world was pretty much permanently at wars during that. So that's only partly true. But, you know, for the U.S. Secretary of State to say that not only is that order more than obsolete, it's actually weaponized against us. And then just the other day, Trump said that the whole purpose why European Union was created was to screw the United States. So, you know, that's interesting. And then, you know, the relationship between the U.S. and Britain, while the messaging has been mixed between Trump and the Brits, there's been a lot of signals that they're not friendly. They're not good relationship.
Oh.
Elon Musk has been pretty savage in attacking the Brits. Donald Trump threw in a couple of punches as well, even though he said like, yeah, we like you guys anyway, and so on. You know, I think that Trump knows exactly that the Russiagate was pretty much a scandal made in the UK, because everybody involved in Russiagate, other than DNC people, was a British intelligence asset. You know, from Christopher Steele, Sir Richard Dearlove, Stefan Halper. There's 7 or 8 names, all of them former or current British intelligence assets. Sir Richard Dearlove was the head of MI6, you know, not like some low-level rogue guy who just, you know, didn't like Trump and went his own way to crusade against him. And then British Foreign Minister and Starmer himself made very nasty comments about Trump, as did some other Labour politicians. And then in the run-up to the U.S. election, Keir Starmer sent 100 British Labour operatives to the United States in order to campaign on behalf of Kamala Harris. Trump understands this. He knows all this. And my understanding is that Trump is a pretty vindictive guy.
Yes.
So I think that the special relationship is pretty much wasted now.
It's over. Okay. So how do you think the next 9 to 12 months looks like then?
I think that the Russians and the Americans are going to be talking their deals. Their deals go in scope far, far beyond peace in Ukraine. I tend to agree with Tom Longo that Russia becomes the guarantor of peace in Europe. That is, I think that they will have a certain control over much of Central and Eastern Europe. I think that in the fullness of time, Germany will do what Germany often ends up doing through history, is allying itself with Russia, because Russia is the only power in the region that is actually a credible partner and ally to Germany. Poles are hostile. The French are hostile. Scandinavian countries are not particularly friendly either. And Germany is surrounded by them. So the only side that they can rely on long-term and develop economic and political relations with is Russia. And I think that with time, this is going to happen. And then, you know, Germany will take up the mantle of being, again, the guarantor of peace for Europe, but it's going to be a different Germany. It's certainly not going to be a Germany of Olaf Scholz or of Friedrich Merz. It's going to be something very, very different from what we have today. It will be you know, kind of a Viktor Orban figure that's going to have to emerge. And then I think that the talks between the Russians and the Americans will also include the Chinese. And I think that their work is going to be a complete overhaul of the global order. So the, you know, this rules-based order is finished. It's dead. And something else will take its place. And I think there's a good, so you see that they're already talking about halving, and this comes from Trump, very encouragingly. They're talking about halving the military budgets of United States, Russia, and China, which would be great. And they're talking about eliminating the nuclear weapons, which would be brilliant. And so if you go into this multipolar global order where major powers become guarantors of peace in their own individual spheres of influence. So we're talking primarily Russia, China, and the United States, but then we're also talking regional powers like India, Turkey, Egypt, Iran, Brazil, then we might be transcending this dystopian time of permanent warfare, of arms race, of threat of nuclear Armageddon, and we might be going into a completely new global order that might be marked by amazing levels of cooperation, trade, partnership, and peace. And so I think there's a lot to be hopeful and optimistic about that.
I would end with that, but I have one more question that is well said and makes me optimistic. But one more question, go back to the very beginning of this conversation. UK and Europe really needs the Ukrainian assets, the natural resources. Assuming that they don't get them, is that, figuratively speaking, the banking sector? Is it just
that? That will collapse Europe and Britain. But it's not going to be a collapse like 1929 or Lehman Brothers. Because by now, you know, with the COVID pandemic, the bankers have staged a coup. They no longer need government to approve them pumping any amount of liquidity that they choose into the systems. So they have complete discretion in that sense. So what's going to happen is that to make sure that the system doesn't seize up, they're going to be pumping more and more liquidity into the system. So it's not going to collapse in that classic bank run kind of way, but we are going to get a stagflation. And I think that with time, we're going to get hyperinflation in Europe and in Britain, maybe Japan, maybe Canada, Australia. Canada and Australia are resource rich countries. So, you know, they might benefit to an extent from inflation because, you know, they export these resources whose prices are going up. So they kind of cushions the blow a little bit. But for Europe and Britain, I think is going to be a dramatic fall. I wanted to say two other things, because people are starting to have different kinds of doubt about the Trump administration. And they might be right, but they shouldn't jump on the conclusion. There, you see, I told you, they cheated us. This is all fake. One of them is a Jeffrey Epstein revelation. So they made a big fanfare about giving part one of the Jeffrey Epstein file to a select number of people who are themselves dubious. And so people are saying, you see, nothing. And the second one is that apparently there's a lot of turnover in the U.S. military ranks, people getting fired, other people replacing them. And so some people are saying, like, oh my God, is Trump preparing to stage a coup and take over as a dictator? Jeffrey Epstein, that file is very explosive and potentially very valuable if you want to achieve something, you know, because if you blow it open in public, then you no longer have control over the people who might be compromised. So the administration might choose to use that file selectively against people because you might use some compromised people to go against others. If you give it away completely to the public, you no longer have that weapon. Second, with the generals, Trump, if he wants to halve the military budget, he's going to have a whole lot of people who are going to want him dead. Because that's too much money for people to say, like, oh, I guess we're not going to get any money next year. The military budget's going to halve. You know, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to say death to Trump. You know, let's JFK him. So, an overhaul of the hierarchy may be necessary to prepare for the next world, because it's not going to be a world of permanent warfare. It's going to be a world of disarmament, of reduction of spending on the military, of elimination of nuclear weapons and so forth. And so you have to get rid of all these people who are completely compromised and who are grifters within the military industrial complex, and who therefore are going to be extremely upset that their gravy train is ending. So, you know, don't extrapolate what you see happening to the most negative conclusion and then just say, like, ah, yeah, it's give it time.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great ending, actually. Just give it time. Let's let it work out. Well, Alex, I do have to, my wife, as I mentioned offline, she's not banging on my door yet, but it's coming. So I do have to leave. And I won't be. I want to thank you. Thank you so much for your time. How can people find you? And I'll put everything in the show notes. You have great analysis. You are in the financial hedge fund world. How do people read your work, and how do they get in touch with you?
So I'm active on X. My handle is @NakedHedgy. I have a daily newsletter for investors and traders, providing trend following signals and commentary on a set of about 17 or 18 key global markets. And then that's called iSystem Trend Compass on Substack. And then I have a personal Substack where I publish a bit less frequently, but which is, let's say, what I publish there is a bit more developed and refined, and it covers a broad, you know, things like economics and history and psychology and a broader range of subjects. That's Alex Craner's Substack. So those three places are where I'm most active at.
Excellent. I'm linking all of that. It'll be in YouTube. It'll be in Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And again, just thank you. I'm very grateful. I'm just very grateful.
Thank you, Andy. Always good to join. And greetings to your viewers and listeners.
Thank you.